You know, we know a lot more about life in the womb than people did years ago. I'd like to tell you a little story. There was, in the Middle Ages, there was a little town, and in this town, there was a very polite family, and they had a very polite daughter. And in the same town, there was another family, a very polite family with a very polite son. And they thought, wouldn't it be nice if that very polite young lady would fall in love with that very polite young man? And it happened, and the whole town rejoiced. The whole town rejoiced. And they ended up getting married, and the whole town rejoiced. And they were hoping that they might have a child, this very polite couple. And time passed, nothing happened. Suddenly, the news went forth, she is pregnant. And the whole town stopped working and waited for the birth of the child. And the 9 months passed, this very polite young woman, very polite young man, and she didn't give birth. It went 10 months, no birth. It went 1 year, 2 years, no birth. And somebody said, we have to get back to work. And she never gave birth. The two of them grew old, and the old man died, and finally she died. And this is true now. As an Irishman, you always say that, this is true. And when she died, people, all the people in the town remembered. She never gave birth. What happened? This very polite young man, polite young woman. And when she died, they said, we have to have an autopsy. You have to find out what happened, why she never gave birth. Now, this is true. Do you know what happened? They opened up the womb of that old woman, a very polite old woman married to the old polite young man. And inside they found, in her womb, two old men with long white beards. Two old men with long white beards, each saying to the other, after you, after you, after you, after you. There was another couple that had twins. They had twins, two boys. And one boy was always discouraged. Everything was going to go wrong. And the other lad was, everything was going to go right. He knew he was going to be a pro-lifer. Everything was going to go right. And they figured, well, both of them, we have to correct this. Everything doesn't go wrong and everything doesn't go right. So it came Christmas time, and they decided that they would give a gift that might correct the fellow who was totally optimistic and the one who was totally pessimistic. So it came Christmas time, and for the young lad that was totally optimistic, pessimistic, they bought a beautiful brand new bicycle. Everything on it, perfect, perfect. See? And they waited for the lad to come down. They showed the new bicycle to him. And when they showed the new bicycle to him, he looked at it, and he went to see. He started to become sad. And they said, why are you sad? This is a beautiful new bike. He said, I know, but what's going to happen is I'm going to go riding on that bike. I probably will be hit with a car. I'll end up in the hospital. And I know my friends. They'll come visit me to borrow my bike. And they won't care about my bike. And they said, oh God, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? How are we going to correct this? Now, the fellow that was totally always optimistic, they said, what will we give him? So for Christmas, they took a Christmas sock, put it on the mantle, and they filled it with horse manure. They said, take that for your gift. See? So the kid comes down, and he comes in, where's my gift? Here it is. And he goes over, and he looks at the sock, the Christmas sock, filled with horse manure. He's looking at it, and suddenly a big smile breaks across his face. And they said, what are you smiling about? He said, you can't fool me. Where's the pony? Where's the pony? That's the pro-lifer. That's the pro-life person. You see, that's the pro-life person. You need total optimism. Where's the pony? There's going to be a resurrection. You know, I was coming back from Eastern Europe, and there's wonderful things happening in Eastern Europe, my friends. Wonderful things. As you probably know, Hungary just passed a new constitution in which, from starting as January of this year, and in the constitution, they have put into it, human life will be protected in Hungary from the first moment of conception until natural death. We have been doing prayer vigils in Hungary for about 17 years. And Dr. Imre Tiglassi, who was involved in that, was one of the persons who got the constitution changed. And in that same constitution in Hungary, they indicated only a marriage between a man and a woman will be accepted in Hungary, no other types. In Poland, as you know, the parliament has overwhelmingly voted now there'll be no more abortions in Poland. Did you know in Russia now, you cannot have an abortion after 12 weeks unless your husband's going to prison? And the president of Poland signed a bill about 5 months ago in which it indicated no one can advertise an abortion in Russia unless you include in that advertisement, abortion is a dangerous medical procedure for the woman in Russia. Okay? Marvelous things are happening in different parts of the world. Let me tell you that, okay? Let me tell you that. Well, I was coming back from one of the trips to Eastern Europe, and I just gave you some of my reflections as I was coming back. I said, these days, one would be blind or deaf not to read in the newspapers or hear on radio or watch on television the unrelenting attack by so many commentators against the Catholic Church, going on for years in the United States, and now most recently in Western Europe, for the shameful deeds of a few. One commentator went so far as to say, this may be the end of the Catholic Church. And I thought to myself, you foolish man, it's not the end of the Catholic Church, but rather of Western civilization, whose flawed leaders, by misusing words such as freedom, choice, equality, have anesthetized the people into passively accepting the removal from the laws of the land all Judaic and Christian values. Without these ethical foundations, Western civilization will collapse and perish into barbarism. For it was the implementing of the moral values found in God's commandments and the recognition in law of the absolute value of every human life created by God that made the laws in Western civilization great and admired. The late Archbishop Fulton Sheen said it is a characteristic of any decaying civilization that the great masses of the people are unconscious of the tragedy. Humanity in a crisis is generally insensitive to the gravity of the times in which it lives. Men do not want to believe that their own times are wicked, partly because they have no standard outside of themselves by which to measure their times. If there's no fixed concept of justice, how shall man know it is violated? Only those who live by faith really know what is happening in the world. The great masses without faith are unconscious of the destructive processes going on, because they have lost the vision of the heights from which they have fallen. Country after country for the legalization of abortifacients, contraceptives, euthanasia, abortion itself, embryo stem cell research, therapeutic cloning, is institutionalizing a structure of sin and death. Organizations such as the European Union and the United Nations too often are becoming the problem and not the answer, due to certain powerful people and groups which manipulate even these institutions into implementing this worldwide culture of death. Thus, tragically, today, the light of life for far too many innocent human beings is going out, especially across America and Western Europe, without a whimper from the majority. The light has been dimmed ever so slowly, so that many, without realizing it, have acclimated themselves to live in moral darkness. Others are already despairing of the hope of a new dawn, while those who, being born into the darkness, accept it as the normal condition. Pope Benedict XVI, in his encyclical letter Caritas in Veritate, he pointed out that the particular ethical battleground today in this culture struggle between the supremacy of technology and human responsibility is in the field of bioethics. Is man a product of his own labors, or does he depend on God? Development must include not just material growth, but also spiritual growth. Since the human person is a unity of body and soul, born of God's creative love, and destined for eternal life. When man is far away from God, man is unsettled and ill at ease. Social and psychological alienation and many neuroses that afflict affluent societies are attributable in part to spiritual factors. There cannot be holistic development and universal common good unless people's spiritual and moral welfare is taken into account, considered in their totality as body and soul. The supremacy of technology tends to prevent people from recognizing anything that cannot be explained in terms of matter alone. But the spiritual dimension must be present for authentic development. True development requires new eyes and a new heart, capable of rising above a materialistic vision of human events, capable of glimpsing in development the beyond that technology cannot give. How is it possible that we now have more knowledge of the development of the child in the womb than any other people in the history of mankind possessed, with less respect for life in the womb than any previous generations? We have gone from 3D to 4D sonograms machines that allows us to see clearer than ever before what the baby in the womb looks like. How can we justify aborting the unborn child whose every move in the womb is now clearer than ever to us? We have made great advances in human fetology and embryology. Moreover, as a result of the science of modern molecular biology, we now know that the human body contains about 10 trillion cells with identical genomes. And each human cell contains about 10 feet of DNA coiled into a dense tangle. The Human Genome Project of 2001 decoded at least 60,000 genes in each cell. Stretches of DNA around and between the genes seemed at that time to do nothing and were called junk DNA. In the following years, the scientists started the epigenome project to further decode the cell to learn how the genes work in order to correct diseases. To the surprise and the amazement of scientists, they have discovered that the so-called junk DNA contains genetic switches controlling how the genes function within the cell. Scientists now believe that errors or mutations in genetic switches can disrupt the network and lead to a range of diseases. The analysis was daunting since the research has generated 15 trillion bytes of raw data. Analyzing the data required the equivalent of more than 300 years of computer time. How great is the wisdom, the intelligence, and the power of God, who creates a single cell that contains in itself a whole universe of information. How humbling, how great and worthy of praise are you, our God. And then I think, in spite of this enormous information that we now have about the very beginnings of human life, of how many young women today going into abortion mills around the world, to this very day will be demonically told by the abortionist that the newborn life within their womb is just a blood clot. They tell them that the unborn child is not human until it looks human. They will totally neglect or suppress the advancements in the science of fetology, embryology, and the incredible findings of human life at its earliest stages by modern molecular biology. To establish a culture of life, the moral blindness to the sacredness of life, the proper use of human sexuality, and the importance of marriage as a home and sanctuary of life as God designed it must be restored. Since the blindness is worldwide, we need to ask once again the Mother of Life who stood at Calvary, pleading and interceding with her Son, to free us today from the moral blindness from sin, and restore family once again as the sanctuary of life. In the face of the culture of death, family must be the heart of the culture of life. If not there, where? If not now, when? We need Christian heroes whose virtuous lives will serve as a rampart against the relentless attack on family as God designed it, on human life as God created it. We turn thus again to Mary, the Mother of God, and we ask her intercession with her Son, who alone can crush the head of the serpent and restore a culture of life. It's important for us to realize the attack on life and family is done so frequently by godless sex education programs, especially in our schools. The word of God is not mentioned. The education in secular schools excludes God and God's plan for sexuality. God and God's plan is at the heart of Catholic sexuality. There are objective norms that require self-control and discipline. We must treat human problems with human solutions. The secular world has given up hope in our young people's ability to practice self-control, to be chaste. It is not the children's fault that many of their teachers and so-called learning materials are hopeless and normless. You can't tell young people that freedom is their right to choose any behavior they wish or want and feel is right, and then admonish them for the results of becoming pregnant or sick with venereal diseases, even dying of AIDS. Our young people should be challenged to be chaste, because chastity means living within the limitations of reality, living within the truth. The very structures or apparent limitations free us and allow us growth. A society without structure is a contradiction. A society without norms or limits results in disorder, chaos, and destruction ultimately for all in such a society. The perennial sin of pride always wants to remove limitations and do away with God. The creature refusing to obey the limitations that God wisely informs us about, because only God is limitless. If only we should eat or could eat the forbidden fruit, we would be like God. I can put as much air as I want, so to speak, into the tire, but you can, but may you. When the tire explodes in your face, no one will have to tell you the wisdom of our behavior conforming to the built-in limitations of the reality of being the creature, not the creator. You have to start with the positive design and purpose and plan of God in marriage and Christian marriage and work backwards for someone to understand why they should restrain and control themselves until married. Otherwise, young persons only hear the adults telling them, you can't do this, you can't do that, and it seems so negative. If a young person does not know God, nor understand God's creation and beautiful plan for newness of life, found in the very design of their own bodies, how can they understand today's culture that largely ignores or attacks Christian, Judaic norms of morality as antiquated and dated? A Christian today is under attack from those who want to establish a culture without norms, or at least without standards derived from Christian and Judaic traditions. For them, any law that limits freedom by truth is anti-democratic. Freedom is limited by reality. A vision never becomes a reality through wishful thinking or broken promises. It requires clear focus on truth, discipline, and self-sacrifice. All authentic love between a man and a woman, when it's not egotistic love, tends towards creation for another being issuing from that love. For some, love means to love oneself, and often such love is no more than a juxtaposition of two solitudes. But when one has passed beyond the stage of egoism, when one has truly understood that love is shared joy, a mutual gift, then one comes to what truly is love. True love cannot deliberately separate its love from the fruit of love, fecundity. It imitates the creating act of God and gives life and sacrifice on behalf of life. How did we get to this position? How? Well, there was a book written by a professor in the University of Chicago. His name was Alan Bloom. And he entitled the book, The Closing of the American Mind. And he indicted higher education for failure. Failure of not providing our students going to universities to be able to answer the most basic question, who am I? Why do I exist? It's a Socratic question, goes all the way back. And he says, we have done that by an education that emphasizes productive knowledge as opposed to directive knowledge. Productive knowledge is this: we teach you how to make a living. Directive knowledge is we teach you how to live. And the only way you can learn how to live is by opening up to these young people, all the generations that have preceded us. They have so much to tell us, so much to give. And then we can weigh our present experience against theirs. So for example, 500 years ago, before 500 years before Jesus, there was great tragic writers in a city called Athens. Sophocles, Aeschylus, among them was a man called Euripides. And the place of women in society at that time was low. And Euripides tried to uplift the place of women in society. And all his plays always have the name of a woman. And he wrote a play which I'd just like to briefly tell you about, called Acestes. The basic play theme was this. The god Apollo, up in Mount Olympus, he fell out of favor with the king of the gods, and he was punished to go down to earth. Well, here's a punishment, to go down to earth. And he was looking for hospitality. And the king of Thessaly, Amidus, he allowed him to stay at his place. And finally the time came where he could go back to heaven, and he wanted to thank the king for giving him hospitality. He said, I thank you, but I also have some news to tell you, good news and bad news. I've learned from the fates and the gods that you are going to die shortly. But I've asked this favor of the fates and the gods, if you could find someone in your kingdom who would die in your place, you will be spared. So the king said, thank you. So he started to go around his kingdom and he said, it's time for taxes. Everybody said, sure, here's the taxes. And he said, would you also die in my place? And he didn't get too many buyers. They said, are you kidding? Here's your taxes, go get lost. And he couldn't find anyone in the kingdom to die in his place. So finally he came to his parents. And he said, now, my good parents, I am your son. You as good parents, you should die for me to save me. And the parents said, what kind of a son have we raised? Are you kidding us? Life is a precious gift. Everybody's life is important. You carry your cross, we'll carry ours. You live your life, we'll our. What kind of a son? We will not. We will not. And so he couldn't find anyone. And finally his wife, Acestes, she said, I will die in your place. And he said, oh, how blessed I am. What a wonderful life. And she then started to get sick and sicker. And everybody in the kingdom knew she was getting sick and sicker. And what happened was, they start to talk about the king. How could he do this? How could he have someone else die in his place? What kind of a king do we have? And the only one, his reputation went down to the bottom. He had no one. And the only one in life that loved him was the one he was losing. The one he was losing. Because he refused to carry his own cross. His own cross. And he pleaded with the gods, will you please change that? Change that. Now, I say that little story to you because there's something to tell us. Do we not ask others or someone to die in our place constantly? Who is that one? It's the unborn child. And they don't even ask for consent. And it's not a life for a life. It's a life for, well, I want to go to college. It's a life because I don't have the money. It's a life because all reasons, not even a life for a life, and without consent. 500 years before Christ, we knew that was crazy. Carry your own cross. And what happens, of course, I'm outside the clinics every day, as you know. I speak to them before and after the abortions. I do. And the great lie is this. They tell the American woman, if you have an abortion, it can bring back yesterday. Bring back yesterday. And they want to believe that. And they go in almost deafening themselves and blind themselves. Yesterday, yesterday return, yesterday return, yesterday return. And they have the abortion. And the first reaction after the abortion is, thanks be to God, my womb is empty. I can get on with my life. And 10 minutes later in that recovery room, total different reaction. My God, my womb is empty. What have I done? This child who loved me, the joy of my life, I have killed. God, forgive me. And I, as you know, I'm outside the clinics, not only before the abortions, but after the abortions. And so often a woman will come out to me after the abortion, and she will say, Father, after what I just did, could God ever love me again? You see, because her self-esteem is down through the ground. She feels neither man nor God nor anyone could or should love her after what I just did. It's like the king of Thessaly, Amidus. If his wife died, he would say, my God, the one person who could have brought me joy and loved me, I killed. Eh? And when they come back out and they ask me that question, I do say to them, wrong question, Mom. Wrong question. Why is it the wrong question? Very important to realize this. Because God, Mom, understand this, God never stopped loving you. Never. He loved you when we were sinners. He died for you. God's not changeable. God has the question for you, Mom. Will you love God again? That's the question. And we try to bring him back immediately to God. People shouldn't be waiting. And most people have abortions. They're never going to ask for help. You get 10 or 20% will ask for help. But we know who they are. We know where they are. And they should be told immediately that God never stopped loving them. And they should find that out through you who are present at these sites. Very, very important to bring them back to God immediately and quickly. And the child, most women who have an abortion, they think the child is gone forever. It is not true. It's not true. That child never did the wrong thing in its life. And the spiritual soul is no impediment for receiving the fullness of life. And it does, and it goes to God. That child's with God. And never stop loving Mom and Dad who did this to the child. Like God. Same thing. They act with the same mindset of God. And it's important for them to know that. That they're a mother of this child forever. And that body will be restored. And you want to see your child again. You must come back to God. God wants you, and your child wants you to say, I'm sorry. Very, very important, you see? So what happens is, when the mothers come out, and the lie of sending someone else to die in your place, rather than you carry your cross, it's your job, it's your responsibility, and God will help, God will provide for you, and not to go down this path again. You know, there was a play written by Terence, a Latin writer, called The Self-Tormentor, and again teaches us something. A very famous line is in that play. There was a man called Menedemus. And Menedemus was a rich man. And he suddenly started working from sunrise to sunset. He had many slaves. And he was killing himself. Everybody said, he's crazy. Why does he let his servants do this? He keeps working and working. And anybody that came to him, he said, mind your own business. Mind your own business. And so finally, people say, oh, leave him alone. He's crazy. And so finally, Cremes, he went to him, and he got the same answer, mind your own business. And Cremes said the famous line that we know to this day. Okay, he said the line, he said, almost sum, umani nihil ame aliena puto. I am a man, and I consider nothing touching humanity to be foreign from me. If what you are doing is right, explain it to me so I can imitate. But if what you are doing is wrong, as my brother and sister in humanity, I must correct you. I put it further. I am a Christian. And if, as a Christian, I have responsibility to my fellow Christian, whatever you do to the least of my brethren, I will consider as done to me. Why do people say to you, mind your own business? When I go to suicide ward counseling, I am a man. Nothing touching humanity. This is my brother and sister. You are my brother and sister. This is my business. I am a Christian. This is my business. And I will speak and I will let you hear what I have to say. And ultimately, they're very grateful. As Cremes finally had someone who persevered, he changed his life, the story came out, and he was healed. The last thing I would say to you is this, that we can learn from the past. What past? From the scriptures. What scriptures? Calvary, the crucifixion. It's there you find the answer to this. This battle, my friend, is not a social issue, period. This is a spiritual struggle. The culture of death started in the Garden of Eden, demonic, convincing our parents, you don't have to take any limitations. Do what you want. You'll be just like God. And suddenly their own children were killing each other. But in the garden, we also found out the answer to establishing the culture of life. And there is no other answer, ultimately. I will send a woman and her son, and he will crush the head of the serpent. If you try to establish a culture of life, my friends, with any amount of education, all these things are important, but you neglect the woman and her son, you will not succeed. And so it was on the Feast of Our Lady of the Rosary that we took serious the woman and her son. And God has moved it all over the world. But when you go as the woman and her son to where? To Calvary, the modern day Calvary, where the unborn children are dying, where the mothers are being exploited. You see, this is the Achilles heel of the pro-abortion whole movement. Remember Achilles? He was invulnerable because his mother took him as a child, held him in the river Styx, the waters washed over his body, and he became invulnerable where the waters went. But he forgot his mother was holding his heel. And so when Paris shot the arrow, he couldn't shoot an arrow straight. He was aiming for the heart. He hit the heel. And poor Achilles bled to death. He found he had a weakness. The Achilles heel, my friends, is simply this. They talk about women's health, reproductive rights, the woman's health, so forth. My friends, if you go to an abortion clinic, there's absolutely nothing to do with health, sickness. You have two people walking into a building that are perfectly healthy. What happens later? One comes out dead and the other spiritually wounded. What in the name of God has to do with health? And I should fund this? It's indefensible. And when you go there, what happens is rather simple. It's indefensible also on their part. And if you speak to them before, but when you go there, you must go there with the mindset and the heart of Jesus Christ and Mary and John at the foot of the cross, or you waste your time. You're not going there to witness the truth. You're going there to convert people to the truth. And you're going there not primarily to save babies. Their souls are going to God, my friends. Take it from me. You're going there for... They are not part of the culture of death, the unborn children who are dying. Make that clear. They are receiving the effects of the culture of death. The people doing this to them, that's the culture of death. And their souls are precious to God. Jesus went to Calvary to die for the people who are putting him to death. You must go there with love in your heart for the people who are involved in the culture of death. You must go there and pray and reach out with God's love, unconditional love, to whom? To the people killing the babies. To the people working there. Jesus loves them. Jesus wants their salvation. And he only can do it through you. The risen Christ is not tired, but he continues his work of the Father through his mystical body, the church. And it's through you that the risen Christ continues this work of reaching out. But you must make present Jesus. You're not there to protest. You're not there to picket. You're not there to in self-righteousness. And you're there primarily for the people in the culture of death. If you change their hearts, the children will live. If they don't live, they go to God. But we still need to save these people. But you must be there in the manner and the way as Jesus Christ. You must be there out of love. Now, when you go there and you're there in love, things begin to change and to happen. You become a Christian. The last commandment God gave to us, love your enemies. You want peace on earth? I got the answer. Love your enemies. You can't have peace without forgiveness. You can't have peace without Christ present in the world today through his people. And so you go there with this mindset of Jesus Christ. And through you, you make present. You make present this unconditional, everlasting love of God. And you become a Christian. And everything changes. And when you do that, what happens, of course, is you change. And this is the place which is there, where it's a culmination of the culture. Death becomes their weakest spot. It becomes the place of conversion. What's the greatest evil that ever took place in the face of the earth? The day we crucified our God. And what's the greatest good that took place in the face of the earth? The day God was crucified. We redeemed the world. And so from the new Calvary, the modern day Calvary, from Golgotha, comes the place where there is this change of heart, the change of everything. You know, I tell you this final story. There was a man called Joey. And Joey was addicted to drugs and drink. And he went to one of these Bowery places to try to get a cure. And he did. And he was so grateful at the end of it, that he decided he would stay and give his life for those who would come after him to help them to become cured. And everybody that went through that place, they loved Joey. They loved Joey. And finally, it was one evening, there was a ceremony going on of healing. And a man came up and he was kneeling on his knees in front of the altar and he said, "Oh God, make me like Joey." And the priest heard it and he said, "You should say, oh God, make me like Jesus. Make me like Jesus." And the man looked up quizzically and he said to him, Was Jesus like Joey? Was Jesus like Joey? They have to see you and say, was Jesus like you? You have to be present with love in your heart. You have to be present that they can see this unconditional, everlasting love of God for them who are caught in this culture of death. And when they do, the conversions will begin. And when they do, you play places that you're closing. Yes, we did a place God just closed in New York City, but my friend, that was the 25th abortion clinic in New York City that closed. That was not the first, it was the 25th. And clinics are closing and parts are being converted all over the world. I just came back from Austria, Belgium, Paris, France, California, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, all over the world, okay? And I find people like yourselves all over the world, okay? Finally standing at Calvary, being Christ to this world, and God working through you. And when you stand there, then everything else good happens. Life centers, post-abortion healing, everything follows from that. But if no one is at the site where this is happening, God help us. I close with this thought, this final thought. Imagine if, some people say to me, "I was standing outside praying, Father, there were no turnarounds. Should I go? Is it worth it?" My friends, at Calvary, the first Calvary, no turnarounds. Jesus died. No turnarounds. But imagine if today we know the people who stood there, the five people who stood there, everybody knows their names. And they were standing there not because it's going to be a turnaround. Someone in the middle of a culture of death, when they say to us, "Did you know where the babies were going to be killed? Did you know where the mothers were going to be exploited? Did you know? Did anybody know?" Yes, we did. Was anyone there? Imagine if there was no one with Jesus when he died. And we didn't know his final words. We didn't know what he said. What an indictment. And they stood there against the whole culture of death, Barabbas, Barabbas. And they stood there and said, "No, this is God's precious son." You stand there and you say, "This is God's precious infant. This is wrong." Even if the children die, people will remember. You see, because there is a resurrection, as Jesus rose from the dead, there is a resurrection coming. Trust me, there will be a new culture of life. And people will say, and they will ask, "Did anyone go and pray outside these places as did Mary and John of old?" And you will say, "Well, there was some people that did go. Who were they?" They called themselves Christians. They called themselves Christians. And they kept alive the culture of life. When everybody else was saying, "Barabbas, Barabbas, it's okay, it's free." Then we can finally say, "No, there were people who stayed there and stood there with the infants, with the mothers, with Jesus. And they reached out to in love to the people doing this, as did Jesus, for the conversions to begin. And they will begin. And that's the source of the victory. Do not ever lose heart. Go to Calvary, and from there will come the greatest good. God is not in heaven saying, "Oh my God, what's happening with this culture of death?" No, no, no. The greatest evil, the day Jesus died. The greatest good, the resurrection when Jesus died. This culture of death is allowed by God because I see all over the world it's creating incredible, wonderful Christians like yourselves. Forgetful of your own thoughts and what you want to do, and you give yourself. And when you go to Calvary, and there is, when you go there and you make present Jesus Christ, you change. And you become the instrument of changing others. And there will be a rebirth of a culture of life, because there were people who did go who called themselves Christians. And may they in the future ask, did my mom, did my grandma, what did they do? Did they? Yes, they were at Calvary. They were there. And they tell us the story about how they could not put out that final light or life because they stood there with Christ. And he brought the light and the life of Christ to the world until the resurrection took place. And it will take place. Trust me. Believe in God. Thank you.